Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. Each episode covers the brightest and boldest ideas from the world's leading experts in software development. Tune in for practical lessons, compelling theories, and plenty of inspiration. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of GoTo Book Club. I'm Thomas Vitale. I'm a software architect at Systematic in Denmark. I'm really passionate about Java, about Spring Boot, about cloud native technologies. And today I'm really, really happy to introduce you to Mark Heckler, the great Mark. He's a principal engineer at Microsoft. Before that, he was a developer advocate in the Spring team. And he's also an airplane pilot. How cool is that? Right, Mark? How did you get to become a pilot?
Oh my gosh. Well, thanks. I'm just happy to be here. You and I have chatted over several years in various different venues, and it's never enough time. So I'm just happy for another excuse to drink coffee and chat and catch up. But yeah, I mean, ever since I was a little kid, I always would look up at the sky when I'd see a plane or hear a plane go over and try to find it. It was something I always wanted to do. I kind of had a couple of like intro, like just touch points over the years, but nothing very serious until a few years ago when I decided to make it a little more serious. And then over the pandemic, I actually wound up completing my private pilot's license and then my instrument rating. And I have a simulator back here that I use when I can't get out, you know, when the weather is just terrible for a long stretch of time or something. Plus, I'll throw in a shameless plug. Microsoft Flight Simulator is just gorgeous and just really beautiful to fly with from a desk. But yeah, my wife and I bought an airplane. It's not like big, fancy or anything like that. It's just a very solid, stable, nice plane. And we take nice trips, you know, and it's just fun. It's kind of fun to apply the analytical abilities as a developer to something different and kind of exercise your brain in different ways. I often, if you've ever flown or talked to aviators or pilots, sometimes they talk about the visual flight rules, VFR flying, where you have to look outside the cockpit and you're looking around at you know, maintaining horizon situational awareness and looking for aircraft. And then when you get your instrument rating, you take your focus back inside the cockpit, not exclusively, but obviously if you've got, you know, very poor visibility, all you can see is your instruments. But for us, for people like us, I mean, that's perfect, right? Because we trust the computer all the time. So whether it's analog gauges or digital and everything's digitized throughout the cockpit or not, nothing is, you know, you've got this full spectrum, you know, this full range. But it's a very natural, I feel like, a natural feeling for us to focus on trusting the gauges. And that was something that I particularly enjoyed. So it also gives you a lot more flexibility in when you can fly, because if weather is kind of not great, you can still go out and fly and again, get to where you need to go or want to go at that point in time. So yeah, a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's really cool. And perhaps it gives you a fresh perspective about really how software impacts our daily lives, also how important it is that it works, that it's high quality software, that we can trust it, especially in these domains where it's really critical that it doesn't fail. We have to be able to trust the measurements.
It is very true, and you know, you make that's a phenomenal point, because you've got your software which you have to trust. You also have hardware which has to be certified for airframe use or aircraft use, and then you also have the data. Because, like any domain, if the data is stale, you have problems. Well, of course, in aviation, that could be life-threatening. So you have data that's provided by governments and by companies who bundle this up and supply it as data feeds or packages to your equipment. So it's kind of the three-way connection, the three-legged stool. You know, you get the hardware, software, and the data, and all of those have to be good, current, fresh, reliable, resilient. You know, in aviation, everything is usually too deep minimum. And the same thing with our systems. You know, you have some form of resilience and some capacity to make sure you're always online, always servicing your customers and your community's needs. And that's absolutely critical. And we do that kind of, I don't say without thinking, because we're always thinking about that stuff, but it becomes such a naturally ingrained part of our lives that we just do it kind of, pardon the expression, on autopilot, right? Everything we do, we try to look at maintaining that backup plan and two or three levels deep. And whether we incur those costs or whether we just make those plans, one way or another, we have to accommodate those kind of situations.
So true. Yeah, it's really great to chat with you today. Like, yeah, as you said, we've been talking virtually for a while, and we finally got to meet also a couple of months ago at DevOps. It was great. Today we are here also talking about your latest book, Spring Boot Up and Running, a really great book. Yeah, I can see the cover behind you, Spring Boot Up and Running. So how come, did you decide to write this book? What was the idea behind it? How did you decide to approach like covering this subject?
Oh, that's such a terrible question to ask me, because I feel like just by doing it, I broke promises that I'd made to myself. I had been asked and invited to contribute content and code to other books before, and I'd even co-authored a couple of them with just a phenomenal team of friends and fellow developers across different companies and parts of the industry. And I had a great time. But I realized very quickly how much work went into creating to creating the content and writing it and capturing it clearly and making sure that you kind of stayed on message and didn't like amble for 60 pages in a chapter, or didn't like wrap it up in five. And there's always this balance, what you include, what you don't include, and trying to get across the finish line. Well, when you have a team of folks who are doing that, it's challenging. But when you look at the amount of work that is involved and you think, wow, would I want to do that all by myself? Well, the upside is you get full creative control, well, to some degree. I mean, you have an editor and a company that you're working with to publish generally. But the downside is all that work falls on you, and the graphics and the examples, the diagrams and the, I need to wordsmith this a little better because I'm not satisfied with it. Instead of going, hey, Carl, you need to maybe rework that or something, because that's not exactly clear what you're saying. You have to try to read that and catch that. And of course, you have technical editors and stuff too, but you're trying to constantly write and revise your own stuff. And it's a huge amount of work. But as an advocate, I was always out talking to folks and doing presentations and just catching people afterward and them catching me and having great conversations. But certain questions would keep coming up. And I had teammates and colleagues who had written books, and they're good books, but everybody, everybody has a different perspective that they say, well, I want to bring these things to the table because I think they're absolutely important. And it's not that you don't think other things are important. You just have to choose. So you choose what to include, what not to include. You choose how to present what you're including, and maybe the extent that you cover it. And sometimes, I mean, let's face it, you'll write an article or a book and you'll say, well, I really didn't cover this one thing as well as I would have liked to, but I just didn't have the space to cover it without cutting something else. But those are trade-offs we all make. And each one of the other books that I would recommend, my colleagues and friends and teammates, I always felt like that their perspectives were excellent, but I had a different perspective. And then when people would come up and say, well, what about this? It's like, well, okay, that wasn't covered really well in this book, but it's kind of covered in this one. And then I'd take a note. It's like, okay, if I ever do write a book, I will include it and I will mention this, because this seems like a recurring theme people are confused about or just curious about. So I had this outline put together. And now a dear friend of mine who is also an editor at O'Reilly contacted me and said, hey, I want to talk to you about doing some work with us and in some other capacity. I don't remember exactly what it was. And we were just having a great conversation, just like we are here now, And somehow I just kind of slipped out. I said, well, yeah, I've got this outline of stuff that I'm putting together, just Spring Boot-based topics that I want to cover at some point, should I ever write a book? And she said, well, like what? So I said, well, this, that, and the other thing. And she said, well, when can you get me an outline? I said, well, I've got it now. I can send it after we disconnect. It's just something I've had kind of compiling over the last couple of years. And I sent it to her, and then she pinged me and said, we need to talk because I really want to do this. And I said, oh, okay, you know, I'm thinking, you know, maybe a year, 2 years out, and I'm still kind of not that interested in doing a solo book. But the more we talked about it, the more I thought, you know, there really is a gap here. Not again, it's just a matter of what you choose to cover and what you don't. And everybody's perspective is different. So I felt like I could add to the conversation in a positive way, hopefully. So I wrote the book. And interestingly enough, it kind of hit over COVID where I spent a lot more time at home. So I won't say I was able to get it done faster, because what happens is you've heard the expression work expands to fill the time allotted to it. So if you allot 3 months to something, it'll take 3 months. If you allot 6 months to it, it'll take 6 months. But what that did give me time to do is iterate on it a little bit more than what I may have been able to. The downside is no matter how much time you have, there's never enough time. There's always this amount of material that you're wanting to put into this much space. And you always still have to cut out things that you really wanted to include and not include them. So what I started doing, as you might imagine, is create a checklist of things like, should I do a follow-on book? I want to include these things too, or in lieu of something that I put in the first book. So I started that list while I was writing the first book, and swearing I'd never do that, and we'll see.
Yeah, so perhaps, yeah, in a year from now, we're going to be here again talking about the follow-up.
Well, you know, it's funny because we have been talking about with Spring Boot 3 coming out, you know, revising. But, you know, here's the interesting thing, because the fundamentals, which I tried to hit heavily on the fundamentals and then lead into some things that were, you know, more advanced topics, more broad-based, you know, and not just beginner topics, but things that led naturally out of those topics. And a lot of the foundational topics have not changed and will not change. You have an increased capabilities, and you have some things, obviously, that tweak and change, of course, with a major version number. But as far as those core fundamentals, the things that we need to know, or that somebody new to the Spring Boot realm needs to know, those are pretty solid. Right. So whether you were on Spring Boot 1.x, 2.x, 3.x, those things at their core won't change. You know, different things about them will. And you can take a few different explorations off in different directions. So there will be definite changes. But as far as the fundamentals, I feel like I've captured those pretty well. That said, like every other author, there are always things like I may tackle that a little differently next time. So we'll see.
Yeah. Spring Boot was really a game changer in the Java ecosystem. Yeah, I remember when I was working with Spring Framework at the university, and one day the professor introduced Spring Boot, and wow, it was mind blowing because like I spent so much time working on a lot of different infrastructural features in the application, like getting all the security done, all the data integration, and then Spring Boot. Okay, so all my code now I can just remove it. It's not needed anymore. And at the beginning, I was a bit sad. Like, I spent so much time on that. And then I realized, oh, wait, I don't need that anymore. Now I can focus on the business logic. And I found out that I spent so much time on all these supporting functions, but not much on the business logic. It was really small. I mean, it was a university project, so it was still a small thing, right? But it was really a game changer for me. What are your thoughts? Like, what was your experience with Spring Boot?
It's funny you mention that, because I think as developers, when we do something really well, like you probably had some really, really clever code in there to do some things. And then when you find out, well, that really great code that I wrote, really tight, really efficient, really elegant code, that's just no longer needed. That's a little, I don't know, frustrating, I guess. But on the other hand, like you said, it's a matter of perspective, because if you look at that, like I worked really hard on that, that's frustrating. If you look at it as, well, great, now I don't have to worry about maintaining that. Now I can go on and focus on these things that really matter to my customers, my users, my community members who are, you know, contributing or using this software, using these libraries, whatever. That's gratifying. So it's a matter of perspective, but it's weird, right? Because many of us come to Spring from the Java EE / now Jakarta EE perspective. Yeah. So we're used to a lot more boilerplate in a lot of ways. And I was not unhappy, you know. I mean, once I always tell people, you get used to as a developer, but specifically as an enterprise Java developer, quote, in the old days, you know, like before Spring. And that could be last month for some folks, you know, it's not like, or next month even. But when you're used to doing things with a lot of boilerplate, the first time it feels like a lot, right? I mean, you do a lot of heavy lifting to open it, to establish a connection pool and open a connection to your database and do different things, you know, just so you can query, just so you can find out how many records are in a table. You know, you do the 50 small steps, you know, I'm kind of exaggerating, yeah. but you have to do a lot of stuff just to find out you have, you know, 50 records or whatever in a table. So, you go through all of this, and the first time it feels like a lot of work. And the second time it still feels like kind of a lot of work, but you're starting to kind of get into the swing of things. So by the time you do that 8 or 10 times, even though you're doing almost exactly the same steps every time, it just feels natural. I mean, this is how it's done, right? So you do this all the time. And then when you come to Spring and you're like, wow, you know, and Spring Boot in particular with Spring Data, and you've got your repository support. And I realize I'm jumping ahead in potential conversation topics if we want to explore this. But when you get to the point that you have a repository and you're extending an interface, and again, for those of you who are not familiar with Spring Boot yet, apologies, but if you read the book, you will be, or many other good books. I you know, I don't want to just point you to mine, although mine's, I hope, you know, it's okay. but if you get to the point where it's like, okay, Spring in general, Spring Framework, and then of course the various Spring projects, Spring Data, Spring Boot, of course, Spring Cloud, Spring Cloud Stream, you know, so many other umbrella projects, Spring Security, they take the position of opinions. So if you do the same thing over and over and over again, and by and large, with very little variation, that's something that's prime for abstraction. That's prime for templatizing. I'm trying to think of a better way to say it that isn't necessarily, doesn't imply a particular implementation here, and I'm failing right now. But it's prime for making an opinion out of that. So if you know that, okay, each time I want to talk to a database, I have to do these 50 simple steps, why can't we take the opinion that those steps are done for you in a consistent way, in this particular way by default? Now, if you need to override that, and this is kind of where I go back before Spring Framework, because frameworks have existed for a long time in a lot of languages, but they weren't always very flexible. So if you wanted to do something, you either did it the framework way or no way at all, because you just, that was the only way to do it. But Spring Framework, and especially Spring Boot building on that, you have a preferred way of doing it, an opinionated way. But if you need to override that, you many times can set a property or define a bean of a particular type. And Spring Boot's auto configuration will look and say, oh, this property is defined. You want to override this capability, so I'll back off and let you do that. So it makes it really simple to do that. But 80 to 90% of the time, if you're doing things the same way over and over again, you just want it to be handled for you so you can focus on, as you said, the things that actually provide business value. So I was to bring this back around, if you're coming from the Java E world, for instance, and you have done things a certain way and it requires several steps to get there, and you come into Spring and you're like, what, I don't have to do anything? I just extend this interface and it's all like magic. You hear that term a lot. You know, it's magic, yeah. Too much magic. Yeah. It's not magic, folks. It's technology. You know, this is a very, very rigorous technology. You know, it works. It's very easily inspected to see what's happening. It's easily overridden. But it is a little disconcerting when you first come into it. So that was my experience too. You know, when I started working with Spring, I was like, hey, I've got all this code that now it's just junk. I don't need this anymore. That's, what's happening? I don't know what's happening under the hood. Well, again, that's when you learn how you can find out what's happening under the hood. So the other thing that I will say is that I know I'm talking a lot. I'm sorry. I'll wrap up on this. But every day you have new folks coming into the Spring ecosystem, you know, people coming from other languages, from other environments, from other approaches, like, you know, using Jakarta EE. And you have students graduating from university. So having a way to share fundamentals and kind of that gentle on-ramp, I think, is super important to get people started, hopefully in a constructive way.
Stay with us. We'll be right back. Should I be excited or afraid of AI? The answer is yes, it's both.
Things are going to look so different in the next couple years. You will not be ready for the disruptions that are going to come. I'm Jeff Nielsen, host of Digital Disruption, the go-to podcast for technology leaders. Our generation's conflict, I think, is going to be emotional, not economic.
The companies that are going to win are the ones that have a couple of characteristics.
Stay ahead of the curve with Digital Disruption, available now on your favorite podcast platform.
Yeah, that's actually why I liked the way you started the book. So like focusing on the main features of Spring Boot, for example, dependency management. So you don't need to care about that. If you want to just start, you're starting right now with Spring Boot. You don't have to worry about that. You have these starter dependencies, which are great. You explain auto configuration. So it's not magic. Yeah, as you said, like there's code like doing things for you. So you can inspect the code and see what it's doing. And if you're not okay with that, you can change it, customize it, because it's completely flexible, even if there are these opinionated conventions in the code. And as you said, one of the main thing, I guess, was data integration, that also you spent a few chapters on data integration and also different level of abstractions provided by the framework, which is great because the reader gets different perspectives at different levels of abstractions, and also getting familiar with different ways of solving data integration, and based on some use cases, you can choose one way or another. So I really like that. Let's talk about that. Like, how did you decide to approach that topic, and what are your thoughts on that?
I knew you were going to ask that. I mean, this is tough because I mean, everything we do revolves around data. And as we kind of were talking about the flight data, you know, the airport data, all that stuff, it's sometimes very critically important, you know, like life and death important. Sometimes it's just, you know, very useful. And I don't want to say it's less important, although it's hard to argue anything's more important than actually life versus death. But the data is what really adds value to most applications. There are a few applications that are that the reason for being doesn't revolve around data that's either provided or received, but generally very few. So it makes sense to have a robust way and a consistent way to deal with data that you're receiving or storing, retrieving and storing in some fashion. Spring Data is the data umbrella, I guess you'd call it, the project umbrella for various ways of interacting with data stores in the Spring Boot and Spring ecosystems. So I've worked with several different databases over the course of my career, as well as several different databases with Spring Data. So whether it's a NoSQL database or whether it's a relational database, I mean, you have capabilities like JPA, JDBC, which gets you pretty much anything relational, with very few exceptions. You have NoSQL databases, so document stores and wide table and graph I'm trying to think like in-memory and caching and just anything. And Spring Data allows you to build on key abstractions that apply at some level across the board. So you have template based access, and then building on that, you have repository based access, because there are going to be certain operations that, regardless of the data structure, are going to kind of be in demand and useful across the board. So being able to find a particular record or instance of something, being able to delete a particular record or instance of something, finding all instances of something. I mean, these are things that kind of cut across all different data stores. So it makes sense to make those APIs very consistent to the point you can, and then to be more specific where you can't. And that's kind of what Spring Data allows you to do. So that was why I felt it was important to do that. I, of course, used an aviation theme in the book to pull from, because I have a little device that pulls in, it's not really radar, but it's position reports from airplanes in the area. And I created an option for if somebody isn't connected to that kind of thing. And I told in the book how to build your own, you know, basically with an antenna and a Raspberry Pi and whatnot. But if you...
I think that was really interesting. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, you chose to use the aviation domain for the example, because sometimes I guess it's hard to come up with examples that are more interesting and educational. So I really appreciated that in your book.
Well, you know, that's I mean, data, even if you generate data, it can be, you know, it's useful, but it's not as interesting as when it's live, you know? And I was trying to think what I could use that was live. And of course, one, my love for flying. But two, you just need something that's like up to the minute. And I wanted to, if somebody isn't connected, I wanted them to still be able to do the examples. But if they wanted to do that, I mean, that's fascinating to see that you've got a Boeing 737 or an Airbus A320 that's flying over you to get to the airport that's, you know, 40 miles away and they're going to be landing, or however many kilometers, sorry. aviation is one of those weird domains that we mix imperial and metric units. So you have all the temperatures in Celsius, you have at least in the U.S., you have barometric pressure in terms of inches of mercury. It's just really weird. And then you have nautical miles and versus statute miles, and some things are statute and some. It's bizarre, but it's kind of, I don't know. Once you get used to it, you kind of tune it out and just kind of go with it. But yeah, live data is always more fascinating, regardless of what the domain is. If you can see it live and it's relevant to that second, I find that much more engaging for me personally. Then, you know, that's why I liked and still like IoT stuff, because when it feeds you a steady stream of current, even if it's just current temperature data, anything that's live is always more fascinating than just canned example data. So that's anyway. But yeah, I wanted to try to show some different examples of Spring data and how it works with the different data stores, to the point that somebody new to the subject would say, oh, this makes sense. I can use this, or this. And this foundation is very similar. It's set up to help me as a developer. And then when I need to deviate from that and I need to go off in a different direction, it's not that hard to do. So that's how I kind of worked out from there.
Yeah, it was a great section. And yeah, really interesting to read.
Well, thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess one other big topic in your book is reactive programming. Also like a couple of chapters about that. Quite interesting topic. I would say, the Spring ecosystem has support for a reactive stack. So we have parity between imperative and reactive. And it's great because we can build using the same programming model. So without having to learn too much new, same abstraction, same interfaces, we can build these more scalable, more resilient, more cost efficient applications. So how did you, cover the topic in the book?
So let me ask you this. Okay. I'm going to answer first with a question.
Yes.
What is your, I don't want to say preference, I'd say it's a little hard, but do you lean more toward the, I'm in the imperative camp, or do you lean more toward the, you know, reactive seems natural, I tend to go with that first, or something else?
Yeah. Okay. So if you're talking specifically on the programming model, so building these streams of data, I feel like it's more natural to me. And when I'm working with imperative applications and try to replicate that programming model, of course, I can't do that 100%. But once you get over the first step, that it might seem too different working with reactive programming, but then it actually, you overcome the first step, and then at some point it just something clicked and you realize, oh, but this feels much more natural to express yeah. the problem that I want to solve. So when I work with imperative applications, I end up trying to do the same, but sometimes I just fail because it cannot be done. But that's my take on it.
It's so weird because my experience matches yours to a T. And that's what I always, because when folks are new to the paradigm, so to speak, and I mean, again, you have to remember everybody comes from a different perspective. So folks who are used to dealing with that kind of thing, used to thinking in terms of events and actors it seems like, well, you know, finally they're catching up. Okay. We're not talking to those folks.
Yeah.
We're talking about the folks who are heavily based on an imperative type of model, a blocking type of model. And in many ways it is very, I don't want to say simple. Nothing is in tech is simple per se, but it's much more straightforward. It's much more approachable. The problem is, of course, that when you start getting into more complex scenarios, it gets very complex very quickly. And that's where you go, well, and where most of us, I think, probably look at and go, well, maybe this reactive thing is something we can use. And of course, reactive streams focuses on those interactions primarily. But it does bake in certain things. It lends itself naturally to a functional approach, to immutability. You know, you have a lot of things. I always tell people it's also based, if you're familiar with, which early on, it seemed like people were, you'd say, hey, have you used Stream API in Java? And they're like, no, I haven't really gotten into that yet. Well, I mean, that was Java 8. So, I mean, it's, you don't probably hear that as much anymore as you did when yes. Streams kind of was starting out. But still, I mean, it's not something that every, especially if you're maintaining brownfield applications, if you're using some older applications, maintaining, I should say, some older applications, you may not use a lot of Stream API, even now. So again, I think it's helpful to remember and realize where folks are coming from, because many times we're out there kind of like reaching out, reaching forward, and not everybody has that ability based on their work environment. So at least not to the same extent, you know, it varies. But yeah, so we're coming into this, let's say we're coming into this new, we're looking at reactive streams. We're looking at, okay, maybe that'll solve my problem. And you look at it and you think, wow, that's incredibly different. And it seems really weird and kind of cumbersome. And I'm not sure I'm following this whole method chaining, and does this make sense? And when does this happen? And why is it not doing anything in the event of not subscribing to it and whatnot, the publisher? So initially it's quite a different paradigm, but then once you kind of get your head around it, you don't even have to be an expert at it. You just, once you kind of understand the concepts and how they fit together, it's like a jigsaw puzzle. You get enough pieces together and you start to recognize the picture and you think, this is actually kind of elegant. This kind of works more nicely than the other does. And yeah, I'm the same way. I kind of approach things reactive first and then look at, you know, the blocking approach is maybe, and it's, again, if you have a smaller application that doesn't have any scalability issues, I always tell people, if you have a brownfield application or system of applications and everything's working, you're not having any scalability issues, your demand is not wildly fluctuating, everything's working, you're not having scaling issues, you may never need to change that to a reactive system, you know, because once you start, if you don't push that reactive streams paradigm throughout the entire pipeline, the entire stack, yeah. You don't gain all of the benefits from it. You sometimes incur some of the costs of it without seeing the direct benefits of it, like any technology choice, right? So you may never change that system out, that system of apps out. But there are many cases where once you start that, then you go, wow, now that I've started here, I can retool this and I can retool this and I can change out my database drivers for reactive drivers. And now you've got, you know, as we said, now you're cooking with gas. Now you've got the ability to do a lot more things and reduce some bottlenecks and improve, as you mentioned, the resource utilization and get more out of the same money you're spending, or maybe even spend a little less to accomplish the job better than you were before. So, sorry, I get on a tear and yeah. I'm the same, kind of the same boat. I like the reactive first approach. And, you know, with things like looming, I think you're going to see more yeah. people have more different options, which options to a point are always a good thing, right? I mean, sometimes you can have too many, obviously, but I think that allows you to take advantage of some of the advantages of reactive programming and still maintain that imperative model, especially if you're coming from an imperative-based application or system of applications. But you also have that as a different option should you want to go reactive. So it's good to have choices. So.
Yeah, it's really good. Yeah, Phil, to recommend, so if you're new to reactive, you're thinking about going reactive, then I recommend first, perhaps having some experience with the Java Stream API, if you haven't used that, because it will make things much easier. Because once you get used to that paradigm of chaining different operations in a more functional way, then when switching to reactive, the new part will be the asynchronous way of how things work. But then the chaining and the stream feels already more natural because of what the experience with the Java Stream API.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Now in its fifth season, Inspiring Tech Leaders is the podcast that talks about technology strategies, challenges, and breakthroughs shaping today's digital world. Each week, Inspiring Tech Leaders brings you technology reviews and interviews with visionary CIOs, CTOs, and industry pioneers. Whether you're leading a tech team or just love innovation, Inspiring Tech Leaders is your go-to source for inspiration and real-world advice. Subscribe now on your favorite podcast platform.
Yeah, and lambdas, and you know the whole back pressure. You know, these are topics and I guess, experience if you've worked with Lambdas before. And again, the further we get from Java 8 in terms of, you know, down the road, the less that's going to be a concern. But, you know, if you're very familiar with Stream API and Lambdas, then you're probably not going to feel too lost when you're starting to work with reactive streams. Again, as long as you remember to subscribe, always subscribe.
Yes. If you're in doubt, just subscribe.
Just subscribe. Yes. Yeah, exactly.
So moving to a different topic, this is one of my favorite subjects in application development, security.
Oh, yeah.
That you also, of course, cover in your book and like that you mentioned, like the overall paradigm and abstractions used by Spring Security and specifically how it's used in two different cases. So when using more standard form login-based authentication, but also more sophisticated authentication and authorization with OpenID Connect and OAuth 2. How did you decide which like features to cover? Because security, yeah, it's such a wide subject.
Yeah, I think that the reason I covered it the way I did is I think if you're writing a small application for like a very small number of users, it's like a, I don't want to say departmental level, because even that's, you know, you've got a lot of considerations there. But if you've got a very small application and you just want to do very minimal security, forms-based authentication does a nice job of it. Now, that said, huge limitations there. But here's the other thing that starting with that gives you is it allows you to introduce concepts at a level that most of us, you know, I always joke that I'm the least secure person there is. And that's not because I don't know anything about security. It's because I don't trust myself. And I think that's a good position to be in, because you should never trust yourself too much. Always, you know, verify everything and double check and have somebody else double check, you know, have the system work for you, the platform work for you to try to secure your applications. But that said, when you start off with something that, quote, relatively simple, I did the air quotes. I try not to do that too much. But when you start off with forms-based authentication and authorization, it allows you to see those concepts in as streamlined a way as possible. So when you look at things like, I'll take it up even higher now for folks who are brand new to this, authentication and authorization. So they're easy to mix up because they both start with auth and we're human, so we misspeak. But generally authentication is you are who you say you are, and authorization is should you have access to resource X. So if you walk up to your company, let's say you're back in the office, or let's say you visit your office and you show your employee ID badge, that's authentication. I am who I say I am, right? So the guard at the front desk lets you on by, you go to the elevators, you go up to the third floor or whatever, and then you swipe into a particular room, or let's say you're coded based on your department. So you have to swipe in. So that's authorization. Am I authorized to be in this room? So you've authenticated, I am who I say I am, and you're authorized to be where you want to go. So the same thing applies to resources, right? I am who I say I am, so I should have access to this application. And then do I have access to this resource? And that's your authorization. Like, okay, this is my photo, this is my document, or things like that. So they're very important concepts. Forms-based authentication allows you to kind of show all those in the simplest way. And then going into the OpenID and OAuth 2 allows you to demonstrate that in a much more robust and scalable and industry accepted and standardized way across the board. And we see various OpenID and OAuth 2 providers, everything from Google, Facebook, Microsoft, GitHub, and I'm trying to think of others. I'm probably a dozen others. Okta. In fact, I used Okta in the book now that I mentioned that, because they're just a great provider as well. But yeah, it allows you to kind of segue naturally, I think, and then get to where you want to go.
Yeah, I like that. You covered all the most important topics, and I like your teaching approach, like how you build on top of most basic scenario, then adding on top of that and showing the reader how we get to the more complex scenario, and in a way that the reader doesn't feel lost. So read Spring Boot Up and Running. It's a great book.
Yeah, hopefully, because I mean, most of the time, I mean, security is one of those topics that I think we're all a little, and again, I think rightfully so, and in a good way, in a lot of ways, we're nervous about, because you're like, it's the stakes are so high in some ways. Yeah. And as a developer, you've spent most of your time working on business value add type stuff, whether it's, you know, maybe you're programming complex chemical equations in a software, or maybe you're programming like change this button to blue. You know, it doesn't matter. You're focusing on the end user experience far more than your focus. And I mean, we can discuss on whether this should be the case, but generally speaking, the functional requirements tend to kind of dominate our thinking. So the I always hate that term, non-functional requirements, but the requirements like security, while absolutely essential and critical to be baked in from the start and all the way through and constantly verified and tested and refined and improved, most of us don't feel as qualified to do that as we do for the functional requirement side of things. So it's easier in many ways, us being human, to go, I don't know where to start, so I just will start. But we need to get past that and start easing into that.
Yeah, and it's critical, so it's important to better understand it. So earlier I mentioned how Spring Boot changed a lot of things. Like when I moved from Spring Framework to Spring Boot, one of the things that I really liked the most was how easy it was to build a production-ready application, basically. So much built in, like with the embedded server and executable standalone jar applications that we really like in a cloud native application, and Spring Boot Actuator, which is amazing. Like out of the box, you get all these endpoints for monitoring and managing the application. You get multiple ways of deploy the application. And I really like that you cover all the most important parts of that in your book as well.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up because when I wrote the book, the Spring Native was early stages, really was, and I debated on whether to cover it, but I kind of, again, it's that space time trade off, and it wasn't really it was present. But there were still a lot of things that were kind of early incubation. There was really nothing going into production, and certainly not advised by the Spring team to go into production at that stage with it. So I intentionally left it off just because there was so much other stuff I wanted to cover. I didn't feel like I was missing it. That will be different in the next edition. But that said, I think in technology we have a hype cycle, right? And I think some of our fellow technologists in other groups and other projects and other organizations really have hyped the whole native code thing. And it's very important. I don't want anybody to mistake what I'm saying. It's important. But like every technology, what we as developers do, and technologists in general, not just developers, but what we tend to do is we find out about a new tool. And, you know, you've heard the expression, to the man with a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Well, that's not just men. I mean, it's anybody, you know, I have a hammer, it's like everything looks like a nail. So that's both bad and good, right? So we get a new tool and we want to hammer everything if we think it's a hammer, right? So everything looks like a nail and we hammer it. And some stuff we find new uses for that are really great. That's wonderful, you know, because we're trying different things. Some things we just start banging on screws and banging on, you know, nuts and bolts and banging on, like, I don't know, pipes and breaking them. So the same thing goes with native compilation. I don't see a time where it will ever replace every JVM based workload, because the JVM does some things exceedingly well. I mean, JVM-based Java applications in some ways can outperform native code. In some ways, they can't. And then you have things like throughput and adaptability and a lot of things, you know, platform adaptability. So there are going to be use cases that fit beautifully for native code and not as beautifully in other ways. So I think the early on in the hype cycle, like all things, you know, it's like native code everywhere. It's like, it's not realistic. Whatever the percentage is, whether 10% of all Java applications will run natively in the next 3 years, 5 years, whatever, or 90%, there will be some percentage, probably somewhere in between, right? So it's a very important part of the story, but it's part of the story. Now it's coming into Spring Boot 3, Spring Framework 6. I mean, you're looking at that becoming an increasingly important part of the story, but I mean, between you and me, do you see every workload going native? Probably not. You know, some number.
Yeah.
So that'll be in there. But coming back to the current edition, those things are still vitally important. You have the ability to deploy and what's typically called an executable jar. Then you have the ability to deploy a fully executable jar, which is a little bit of a misnomer. I mean, anytime you have it embeds a script that you can run on a Linux machine, for instance, where you don't have to do a java-jar, you just run the jar and that works. And there's a great piece in the appendix. I think it's Appendix A or maybe one of the other appendices in the Spring Boot documentation that explains that fully, which is fascinating reading. If folks haven't read that, please go do that. It's seriously, I'm not making this up. It is fascinating reading. And it's a quick read too. So win-win. But you've got container-based applications. You have the ability to create using cloud native build packs to bundle things up and create them as a container, as an image, I should say. And then, which takes any bit of pain that might have been there out of the mix and gives you a lot of the power to, again, deploy anywhere. With Spring native capabilities baked in now, you have the ability to generate native images in containers, which, you know, double your pleasure, double your fun. So you have a lot of capabilities that solve all of those various different use cases and still allow you to use all the best of Spring. And it's just getting better every release, every update. So, yeah. Anyway, I covered all the stuff except for the native Spring native stuff in the edition of the book. And because that was early and rather dynamic and rather fluid, but that, yeah, it's starting to come into its own too. So
yeah, but now with the new version of Spring Framework 6 and Spring Boot 3, we also get it out of the box, like as part of the core framework. So yeah, we're going to benefit from all those improvements, even when working with JVM application, which is, I mean, yes, it's amazing. Like without changing anything, like just by upgrading to the new Spring version, and then we get all these optimizations and we get faster startup time, even when not working with native images or with reduced memory footprints.
Yeah, and see, that's the thing that I think so many times is you know, we miss because when we talk about native code, it's brilliant when it's running, but it's not so brilliant when you're trying to develop for it, right? So there's always going to be that JVM aspect, even if your target, your intended target, is always going, you know, for that application is always going to be native, but it allows you. The Spring team has been super about taking any kind of optimizations that make sense and you benefit from them across the board. So when they can make something work better with native, many times that by default makes it work better with your JVM based, I shouldn't say deployments, but packaging. In many cases, even if it doesn't naturally align, they find ways to make things a win-win, right? So you benefit either way. And you benefit both ways, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah, so we haven't talked about testing, which is also another fascinating subject and very important in our development life cycle. Of course, you cover testing in your book. What are your thoughts on testing and also on the amazing support provided by Spring Boot with the integration test and slice test? We have a lot of help from the framework to actually facilitate writing tests, once again, reducing all the burden on developers to set up the whole framework and infrastructure to run a more sophisticated test.
Yeah, I was talking with another gentleman before, and you and I have talked about this to some degree. I mean, you'd love to approach a book, an intro book even, the same way you would with a new project, which is test first, right? But it doesn't always make sense to do that because then you lose the topic that you're wanting to cover in the surrounding shroud of testing. So what I did is similar thing to what he did, which is you cover testing, but you cover it much later than perhaps you would like. But it makes sense to establish the foundational concepts, I think, first. It's, again, trade-offs, right? As an author, you're going, isn't optimal, but it's more optimal than the option that I could choose with the other route. So testing is critically important, right? One thing that I think Spring does brilliantly is it allows you, as you mentioned, the testing slices. You've got your unit testing. You can do integration testing. You have several different ways and levels, layers. I'm trying to think of the best way to say that, of testing your application and applications to make sure that you have suitable outcomes, whether that be performance and proper values and et cetera, et cetera. Sometimes you hear folks say, well, you know, why would you need slices if you can run through all your tests fast enough that you don't need to do that? Well, again, it's good to have options. And there are many cases that you want to isolate and test a specific isolated bit of functionality. And I think the slices give you, well, I know the slices give you that capability, but let's say you do want to expand the range of them. It doesn't mean you shouldn't focus on making your tests as tight as possible. Because if you just wastefully test, and that sounds weird, doesn't it? But if you don't scope in on the things that you specifically want to test and evaluate, because you can, quote, afford to be wasteful, you may miss things that you want to verify and validate specifically that this works. So it's good to have those options. You can test very specific, tiny bits of functionality to make sure you get the exact response you want. You can test overarching capabilities within an application. You can test interactions between applications, and you have all of those abilities in Spring Boot and the testing that it supports. So I love how I started to say we, but you know, it's the Spring community and the Spring team. I love how we kind of embrace, come in where you need to come in and then build out from there.
Yeah, it's good. And once again, also with testing, we have this convention over configuration and the framework helping us providing these opinions that of course we can customize. And the great thing is that also by like through auto configuration and by looking just at how the framework is built, we get inspiration about best practices and ways that we can also use to build our own customizations and perhaps auto configuration with our libraries in our organizations or extended test capabilities with new slices, depending on the type of applications that we do. I think that's also a great thing that I like about the framework, that also extending the framework, you learn so much just by looking at the code, like best practices and how to solve problems in an efficient way, in an effective way.
Can't agree more. Yeah.
So another topic, perhaps configuration. In conclusion, we can you also covered some configuration subjects in your book, the way that we can configure Spring Boot applications, and also in that case, we get a lot of help to achieve production-grade applications that we can configure in different ways depending on the environment.
That's one of those topics that it seems like such a simple topic, right? I mean, it's basically just properties, right? But it's one of those things that when I start showing people this, it's one of my favorite things to show because it's super simple conceptually. But the extent that the Spring developers, Spring Boot family of developers and Spring Framework and even, again, various projects as they incorporate the, I don't want to say the connections, but incorporate the capabilities, you start to realize the level of thought that has gone into this, into making Spring Boot production ready. Because if you have ways to incorporate the environment, and by the environment, it can be like a configuration server, a config server via Spring Cloud, and which can back into GitHub repositories and Git repositories and Vault, HashiCorp Vault, and just a gazillion different, gazillion, that's a new number. But anyway, a lot of different options from the back end. And then you have just your environment. You can pass things in command line. You can pull from environment variables. You can have cloud platform variables. I mean, there are so many different things that you can use, application.properties, internal and external to the jar. I mean, so many different ways that you can feed parameters, feed configuration settings into your applications. Is that what you meant, or did I just go down a different path entirely?
Yes. Yeah, no.
Okay.
No. That's perfect.
I use that in one of my, like my debugging Spring Boot applications sessions that I just started working out, because it's a very simple concept. It's a simple topic, but it's like, how do you isolate where that's coming from? You need to not make assumptions and say, well, I think it's coming from here. Well, that's no good. Is it coming from here? Where are you getting that value? Why is that creeping into your application? Which ironically, I use Actuator for some as well, because Actuator shows you that source of truth in many ways when you have multiple conflicting paths in to your application for a particular setting of value. And as we mentioned earlier, just having a value defined, just having a property defined can alter your auto configuration, because when Spring Boot's auto config says, oh, you have this property defined, you're overriding this normal set of opinions that I would apply here, that can make a huge difference. again, if you're new to Spring, Spring Boot, that can be a little disconcerting or jarring, as I like to say, pun intended. But it's an extremely powerful tool that you can use as a developer to work wonders on your behalf. So anyway, talk about tying it all together, you know, the configuration settings and the actuator and Spring Boot's auto config, it allows you to do some incredible things very simply.
Yeah, so just to sum up, the great book that Mark wrote, Spring Boot Up and Running, covers all these different topics that we've been discussing today, but even more, like, for example, we haven't talked about web applications and REST APIs, that's covered too, and Reactive is covered also with a lot of different subjects like RSocket, for example, not just HTTP interaction. So you can find, we haven't talked about that, but there are so many interesting topics. So if you're starting with Spring Boot or you're already working with Spring Boot, I still recommend reading the book because there are very useful insights and important features and points that you might not know about of the framework and the features of Spring Boot. So Spring Boot up and running. Where can people find you, Mark? Online, Twitter?
The best way to reach me is like the best way to reach you is Twitter, right? I mean, email is out there, of course. Mark@thehecklers.com is my primary email, but that's the email that I check the least infrequently. I always say my corporate email address, same thing. I check it from time to time, but literally Twitter is the fastest way to reach me. So MK Heck, Mike Kilo, Hotel Echo, Charlie Kilo. It's just MK Heck on Twitter. So reach out to me there. If you just find me there and follow me, and you can send me a DM immediately, even if I haven't even seen your initial follow, I'll get it. My DMs are open. So I encourage questions, comments, feedback, just wide-ranging chats publicly, or if you have stuff you want to talk about privately, don't want to share it with the world, send me a DM and it's all good. But yeah, Twitter's the place to hang, right? I mean, for better and for worse, it's just
it's a good place.
Yeah, it's like the coffee shop online, right? Except you have to bring your own coffee.
And this is where we met.
Yes, that's true. Yeah.
And we haven't talked about coffee. Too bad.
We need more time. Always more time.
Yes. So if you love coffee, also follow Mark.
Absolutely. Yeah. Coffee is where it is. I mean, it's what powers everything else. So.
Yeah. But thank you very much for being here today. You can find the book everywhere, online, paper copy. And follow Mark on Twitter. And thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Have a great day.
Thomas, awesome to chat with you again and looking forward to the next time already.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.